Accession number 4784, Reel 5.
Reverend Cernbash, Reel 5. So you'd like to carry on telling me about
About the water supply. As I say, we found it impossible to make the pits watertight. Then we tried to find water within the campus, and we had our supposed water diviners going all around the camp with the most amazing collection of water divining gear I've ever seen, but all to no purpose. But it so happened that one of the camp boundaries went right down to the sea. There was just the barbed wire between ourselves and the sea. And so we dug seepage pits as far away from the sea as possible to give us a good filtrage, but as near to get a seepage. And that's how we supplemented the water supply. And then there was the problem of getting it into the camp, to the kitchens.
Sorry, I'm not quite clear about that. Where did the seepage come from?
Through the sandy subsoil between us and the sea. That's why I've said that we dug the pits as near to the sea that would give us a seepage. If you got too far away, you wouldn't get anything.
So you mean there was underground water there?
It was the sea itself, with its soaked sand, sort of seeping in to the pits that we dug. And we got them as far from the sea as possible to give us filterage, because seawater is no good, far too salty to use, except for cooking, which we did later on, to cook all our vegetables, because we were so short of salt.
This seepaged water presumably was fairly salt.
Oh, it was brackish, yes. Very brackish, but it was water, and when boiled, it was usable. But the problem then was getting it to the kitchens, which was some considerable distance, and our people were not in good shape even at that time. So the Japanese provided us with carriers, with containers. They were really biscuit tins, which had brought biscuits into the stores in town. And we fitted them all with a sort of wooden carrier. And we turned out all the able-bodied people in the camp at a certain time every day to carry water from the pits to the kitchens. And that's how we got over that particular problem. But believe me, it was very alarming indeed, because no water, no life.
With water supply being a problem, what kind of regulations did you make in order to nurture the resources which you had?
Taps were only turned on by official tap turners for certain periods of the day, and people had to do all that had to be done with water during those hours. Now, you talked about cleanliness too, and the problem of that. Well, there soon came a time when we ran out of any soap that we had. But, as I shall say later, when in our kitchens for fuel, we used logs. And that gave us wood ash. And with the wood ash, we made the old-fashioned but very effective lye. A liquid lye. And with L-Y-E. And with the lye, we kept ourselves and the camp clean for the rest of the time there. We had to be careful how we used it, because it was pretty fierce in its action, but it was a good cleansing factor.
Can I go back to the water?
Yes.
You've mentioned the taps were only turned on at certain times, but were there some uses of water which were forbidden because of its scarcity?
People were very aware by this time of how precious water was. And we knew they could be relied upon to use it very, very carefully indeed. So all that we really had to do was to set aside the times when water would be turned on, and we had our officials who turned it on, and after it had been going for a sufficient period to allow people to do the necessities, it was turned off. Yeah. And that's how we controlled it.
I mean, imagine if it really was in short supply, you would hesitate to perhaps shave as often as you
Oh, most people grew beards. Yes, we were a bearded camp.
And how often did you manage to have a bath or a shower?
After the early days, when the water became difficult, the only time we had a good rinse down was when the rains came heavily and we just went out and sluiced ourselves down in rainwater.
And was hair cutting similarly infrequent?
There again, we had people in the camp who could cut hair. First problem, no scissors. But in the camp workshop that we developed, and here we found the Norwegians were wizard at this sort of work, they made, ultimately, scissors that were used by our camp barbers, and that's how we got our hair cut. So that was another problem overcome.
What about lavatories? Were they...
The whole camp, fortunately, was well equipped with water lavatories. There again, when the water supply gave us all the problems that we had, this was one of the things that we had to watch. We feared there would come a time when something would have to be done about it, and we made temporary arrangements for outside trenches. And they were all ready in case we had to use them. Fortunately, we just managed with our careful usage of water not to have to use that particular system, because it would have been, not very nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With men, women and children there, yeah, in the quantity that we were.
Yes. Did you make any particular arrangements for laundry of your clothes?
There were so few clothes worn that laundry was no problem at all. We found ways of just washing through what bits and pieces we had. As I say, for most of the year, the men wear just a pair of shorts, that's all. And the ladies, shorts and bra. We used to try to look decent when we went to church, and so any clothing we had, we put on, took it off immediately we got back again, so that only needed laundering, any parts of it that did need laundering, on very rare occasions. So we got through that. That was really no problem to us.
Now, before we go on to talk about various details of conditions of life in Stanley, one thing would be very interesting to me is to just have you describe what might be a typical sort of day on camp from, you know, the time you got up, and how the whole thing would, the whole passage of time through the day.
We used to get up in the morning. In the early days, and for quite a time, we served just two meals a day, and that was about 10 o'clock in the morning and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But when we were up against winter weather, and we had two severe winters, we realized that people ought to have something to get up to. And so we set aside quantities of our rice ration and made what the Chinese call congee, a rice gruel. And in the colder weather, we were able to provide a cupful of good hot congee first thing in the morning. And then people went on their various tasks. Pretty well everybody in the camp who could do something, they were on some sort of committee or some sort of working party doing something, either sanitation, kitchen work, wood cutting, workshop, whatever. We had many people who were too old to do anything. It took them all the time to just keep themselves going, doing no sort of job. And then, of course, the children, but they were in school, as I shall describe later. So that was the usual pattern. Get up, have your cup of congee, and then go and do whatever job you were doing in the camp. Then later on, having done that, say in the afternoons, people formed groups. They had bridge parties, that sort of thing. And together with that, we found that we had people in the camp who were qualified to talk about pretty well everything you could ever think of, and in an official way.
Yes. Are you saying that most of the work would be done by the middle of the day?
Yes, if possible.
Yes, and the afternoon would be a period of relaxation.
Of relaxation, when people prayed their bit with each other, went either to their language class, we had several language learning possibilities, or a lecture on whatever lectures were being given. There came to birth a tremendous thirst for knowledge. And we had people who were capable of satisfying that need and giving really first-class and informed lectures. And this was the sort of activity that went on. In the evening, when we had concerts, that's when we had our concerts. We had them in the Assembly Hall of the St. Stephen's Boys' College. And these came to be particularly well done.
Yes, that would hardly be a typical day, I imagine. You wouldn't have a concert every day.
Not every day. Although, when there were productions, they were so difficult to put together and produce that when they were ready, then they'd give one every night, say, for so much, for so long. And then there'd be a period without any sort of concert whilst they were preparing for the next productions.
When did you take your meals, your other meals, at what time?
About 10 o'clock in the morning and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Just the two meals a day.
Yes. Was not roll call part of the daily pattern?
Morning and evening roll call, always. And that was done by the people that we call the blockheads. And then in each area, the various blockheads would give their figures to the chairman of that area. I was the chairman of the main blocks. And we took the morning and evening figures to camp headquarters, which were bang in the middle of the camp. Actually, there were two houses on a hillock right in the middle of the camp, and they had been the residences of the prison governor and his assistant. That became Japanese headquarters, and all our roll call figures were taken there. So there was morning and evening roll call always, and open air count roll call once a week. And as often as the Japanese cared to put one on, if they thought something was happening in the camp, and they'd better count everybody up to see if anybody got away.
Was a large part of the day under the control of the individual internee, from the point of view he could decide for himself or herself?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm. Yes, they could do just what they liked, either engage in these things or not.
Can we talk about food?
Yes.
Now, what were the sources of food that were available to you, and what did you get from each source?
Food was our main and continuing problem. There was never enough of it. We knew there would never be enough of it. We got the Japanese to bring in, and this happened quite early, I'm glad to say, a daily ration. Now, this came in from Hong Kong on the ration truck. We had our ration gang waiting for the truck when it came in, and they took the supplies off and portioned it out to the main area kitchens. And then the kitchen staffs of those main areas dealt with it, cooked it, and served it. Rice was the basic ration. We had that twice every day and never got tired of it. I can still eat rice pudding and enjoy it. The normal ration was about 12.5 ounces per person per day. Our cooks developed great skills in cooking and steaming rice. There's quite an art in this, getting the biggest possible bulk out of it. You've got to steam it. There comes the moment where you've got to draw the fire and let the thing finish off fluffing and bulking. So rice was the main ingredient. We also had green vegetables, sometimes chives, Chinese cabbage, what they call birdseye, sometimes a root vegetable, plantain, sweet potato, and usually just a little meat or fish, and that was the main source of our food. Rice, green vegetable, a few roots, meat, fish, but in limited quantities.
And all these commodities were supplied by the Japanese?
All these commodities were supplied by the Japanese.
Were there any other sources of food?
Now, there came a time very quickly when we realized that our prevailing ration would have to be supplemented in some way if we were going to survive. Now, would you like me to give you a few sort of nutritional figures?
Sure.
I can do. We had a doctor in the camp who was a nutrition expert, Dr. Dean's... yes, Dr. Dean. And he told us that for people doing a normal job, as most of us were doing, would require 3,000 calories of energy a day. If a person was doing a sedentary job, they would need 2,400 calories a day. Our ration, even at its best, which was in the early days, never gave us more than 1,500 calories of energy. And it got to the point where it was only giving us 1,300 calories, and the nutritional experts all over the world said that at least 1,500 calories was needed to keep a person alive, even if he was spending all the time in bed. So there we were, faced with steady extinction. First of all, we cultivated every inch of the ground, the campus, that would grow anything, concentrating on sweet potatoes, peanuts, tomatoes, eggplant, and spinach. It took time for this to develop, but a time came when it was giving quite to the kitchens. Our doctors, who made regular inspections and examinations, found that the weight of the camp was still going down rather alarmingly, people losing weight to that extent, that eventually we were forced into the black market. We couldn't help ourselves.
What do you mean?
I'll tell you now. Now, the Japanese had brought into the camp Formosans to help in guarding the camp. They were a rough, tough, brutal lot, and we didn't like them at all. They gave us a lot of physical punishment. But they were open to bribery. And they became our go-betweens, as between ourselves and the Chinese suppliers in Hong Kong. First of all, of course, we used any money that we still had with us, which wasn't too much. And that's how we paid for the supplies that we bought through the Formosan guards.
This was all quite illegal, was it?
Quite illegal, yes. Then when money ran out, everybody went on to whatever valuables they had. Diamonds, gold, watches, watch chains, wedding rings, engagement rings, cigarette cases. Parker fountain pens were quite useful things to have if you had them. And these were given to the Formosan guards, who turned them into yen, and with the yen bought supplies and brought it into us. And they turned it over to our own black market operators who were operating for us in the camp. So the system was the Formosan guards dealt with the suppliers, brought it in over the wire through the night. Our own black market operators were there to take it over from the Formosan guards. And we bought from the black market operators in the camp. And quite considerable quantities of food came in that way. And that is what is known as black market operations. Totally illegal. In fact, the punishment was supposed to be death. But first of all, we had the Formosan guards into it up to the neck, and we kept them there because then we had them. And of course, when the Japanese saw what was happening and that there was this possibility of a very good rake-off, they came in it as well. So the thing went on and on and on. Now, the valuables ran out...
Could you clear up a point for me?
Yes.
You say you had your own black market operators and you bought from them.
Yes.
These people were really private businessmen working in their own interests.
Yes, our own people. Our own people. But we decided it was worth a while because they were doing a service to us and taking a great risk, and we couldn't expect them to do that for nothing.
How was the money, or the goods? How was that collected? I mean, was it given individually by people, or did you collect it all and use it communally?
The black market operators, of whom there were quite a number, they took over from the Formosan guards And all who wanted to buy knew where to go to whom to go.
I see.
And that's how the individual got hold of it. Now, when all valuables ran out, as they did, people even had the camp dentist, thank God we had one, take their gold fillings out of their teeth. And that gold was sold. And he stopped up the holes with cement. I'll tell you about the dentist later on. When all that ran out, then people went on to undated checks and IOUs. And very often these had to be guaranteed by the leaders of some of the big firms who were in the camp before anybody would play with that sort of transaction. But eventually it became quite common. And people signed checks, signed their IOUs, to be repaid after the war. Now, as time went on, of course, we found ourselves paying more and more for less and less. But people were willing to do this because they realized that they were buying their lives, and that without this, they'd little chance of survival. Because the scale of ration, as I say, 1,300 calories a day, was certain death if it wasn't supplemented. You can imagine what sort of a mixed-up transaction there was to settle up after the war. Well, I happen to know all about this, because after the war, I was one of a committee of three appointed by the governor of Hong Kong to settle up all this business. Now, people had signed checks without worrying in the slightest as to how it was going to be repaid or when it was going to be repaid. All that they were concerned to do was to get some food now. I fear that many hoped that they'd get away with it and would not have to honour their checks or their IOUs. But after the war, very definite regulations were made, sort of bringing pressure to bear upon such people. But as I say, I was on a committee of three who had to settle all this, and although I knew that a tremendous lot of this had happened, I was absolutely staggered when I found the amount to which the camp had committed itself. And it took us well over a year, working darn hard, to settle all these transactions, all that could be settled. Some, of course, people had disappeared, we didn't know where they were, some had died. But all that could be settled, we managed to settle without putting one case into court. And I think our little committee did a very remarkable job.
I'm interested in these, your own black marketeers. I mean, how did they operate? Did they operate from their own billets and have boxes of things under their beds?
Yes.
Did they open up canteens? Or
mainly in their own billets or some hiding place that they had. Which they were pretty sure the Japanese wouldn't know anything about. This is the sort of thing that happens in prison camps. You've got to improvise and adapt in all sorts of ways.
Yes.
Working out a strategy of survival. That's the whole thing. Yes.
These black marketeers sound a bit like the King Rat of the well-known book.
Oh, some of them were heartily hated and despised. But we have to say that they ran a risk and they did us a service. And, we were glad of them. Mm.
When you settled those debts at the end of the war, what would you do in a case? I mean, imagine some of these IOUs and checks had changed hands quite a lot so that the people who presented them weren't always the people to whom they'd been made out. What would you do in a case like that?
We took the view that whoever was holding either the cheque or the IOU was the person to whom we made the repayment. What he'd done in the meanwhile, or what other people had done with him, was their business. We had big enough of a job doing what we had to do anyhow, without trying to sort out that sort of arrangement, which would have been impossible anyhow.
So all checks or IOUs had to be honoured, no matter who presented them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if they
And they had to work that out later.
Were there any other sources of food at all?
No, that was it. The ration, the product of the gardens, the black market. There was no other possible source. And remember, of course, that the Japanese were feeling the pinch of things as things went on, because Allied war craft and planes were taking toll of their shipping, and we knew that in Hong Kong itself, there were great shortages, and these increased as time went on.
Did you ever receive any Red Cross parcels?
Now, I'm glad you've mentioned that. Unfortunately, we received practically no help at all from the International Red Cross, not because they were unwilling, but because the Japanese would not play. You see, they never signed the Geneva Convention, and so they regarded themselves as being outside it. Many people used to say to me, as one of the chairmen of the camp, why don't you mention the Geneva Convention and its provisions for prisoners of war, ration scales and all that sort of thing? I said, the best way to get a hiding is to go to Japanese headquarters and say something about the Geneva Convention. You come with me tomorrow, if you like, and see what happens. So the International Red Cross were up against that difficulty. He went into the camp in, 1941? It was 1945 before we received the first consignment of Red Cross parcels. And that consignment turned out at 2 parcels per head. And they were wonderful parcels, but 2 per head. Not too long after that, we had another consignment, smaller, and that ran out at 1.5 parcels per head. But that meant that all that we received in 3.5 years was 3.5 parcels. Well, just enough to make us realise what we were missing. When we remembered that most camps were receiving almost weekly Red Cross parcels, something like that would have been a boon to us. Mm. It would have made internment very much more happy than it was. But no fault of the International Red Cross. We heard afterwards, and I think it's true, that the Japanese took a lot of the parcels which came to Hong Kong and used them for their own purposes, and especially as the food situation became tighter for them. People who were in Hong Kong and not in the camp and knew what was happening, they told us that after the war.
Of the 3 main sources of food that you've mentioned, what proportion of the total diet do you think, roughly, came from each source?
Rice, of course, as I've said, was the main one.
No, I meant how much of your food came through the official rations. What proportion do you think you got through your own gardening efforts, and how big an element was the black market?
I should say, in the early days, about 3/4 from the ration itself, and that would go down to about half. The gardens would give, say, beginning in the early days, about 1/4, but getting less, and the remainder, whatever figure you work out, black market. So the black market became our lifesaver, without any doubt.
That was about 1/4 or 1/3.
Yes, and everybody who was in the camp would agree with that.
One thing which struck me, listening to the kinds of things you included in the list of items that were available, is that it must have resulted in pretty boring, repetitive meals.
The only thing I can say in answer to that is that when you're hungry, and we were hungry all the time, and sometimes desperately hungry, you'll eat anything. Now, in Hong Kong in normal times, in the streets of some of the poorer quarters, you run across food vendors with their barrows, and they're making concoctions, and you look and you say, I wonder how people can get anywhere near to that, let alone eat it. There were times in the camp when we used to long for people of that nature to come and bring their stuff into the camp. We would have taken it and eaten it gladly. Hunger can make you eat anything and not worry whether you enjoy it or not.
Mm. But how was the food prepared?
Rice was always washed and then put into what we call the woks, steamed and prepared like that. The green vegetables, they were also put into woks, into boilers, and boiled. That's how it was prepared. There's another thing I've just forgotten to say. It comes into my mind now. In the fairly early days, a consignment of flour came into the camp, and we were very excited. We thought, hooray, we're going to have bread as well as rice. And we got busy building a bread oven. We had to build our own kitchens. We had to do everything for ourselves in this way before we could even start and cook. And we got our experts to build a baking oven. The only thing that the Japanese didn't send in with the flour was yeast. And you try to get a fermentation if you've no yeast. Naturally, they refused our request. At least they did nothing about it. And we had pretty well the whole camp experimenting with all sorts of formulas, trying to get a fermentation going. And one day, of course, you succeed. And so we had our yeast, we had our flour, and we got our bakers busy. And what a treat it was when the first newly baked crusty bread came out, and we thought, we're all right, we're saved. And we just got this program nicely going. When we came to the end of the first consignment of flour, no other consignment ever came in, ever, and we had no more bread until the end of the war.
How was that first fermentation arrived at?
Don't ask me what the formula was. I mean, people were putting everything they could think of together in the hope of getting this fermentation going. Somebody in the camp will have a record of what it was that did the job. The main thing was that a fermentation was produced. And once you've got one going, of course, you can keep it going forever.
Was there no other way the food was prepared other than just as plain boiled rice and plain
boiled
vegetables?
No. That's the total monotony of prison camp diet. But you don't notice it because you're so hungry. All you want is something to satisfy the pangs of hunger. You'll find it difficult to believe that, but it is so.
What